Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to welcome you all to today's edition of All Sides Weekend Books, and we're going to have a party. Buckle up here. We are going to have a discussion of books, and we are going to say goodbye, I think temporarily, because there's always technology and Zoom, to a beloved panelist, and we are welcoming an especially beloved local author who has a worldwide reach and a new book, beginning with Michelle Herman, who is incandescent. She is a dancer, an author, an emerita professor of creative writing at The Ohio State University, a mentor to many, and her new book is called If You Say So, a new collection of essays, and you won't put it down. You might even sign up for dance classes, as some of us are tempted to do after reading this. Cassie Rose is here. She is always the adult in the room. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and there is no show without Cassie Rose, and if you love to read and you love books, Cassie is your best friend, and her blog is thelongestchapter.com. And we are saying goodbye. I'm not speaking to him, to Nick White, who is leaving The Ohio State University, where he has been on the creative writing faculty for a number of years, and going to Harvard. I'm from there. I can say it that way. He's going to Harvard University to join the faculty there. He's packing his trunks almost as we speak.
Finish this show, I will be going back to my office, getting things together.
And he is a published writer. He is a very, very important and much-loved member of this program. And so I'm going to start with Nick White, since you're busy packing and you took an hour off to come and say goodbye to us today. So, Nick White, what do you have for us to read?
So I am reading a book right now that people have told me to read for years, and I have just put it off because for whatever reason, the beginning of the book kind of turned me off a little bit. It's written kind of like a play at the beginning, and it sort of, I don't know, it was hard to get into, but I figured it's the summer. I wanted to read something that I've never read before, and I wanted to read something that was good, that I knew was good because so many people I trusted had recommended this, including Michelle Herman. And so I sat down, I gave it a try, and I'm only maybe like halfway through it right now, but it's one of those books that I know is going to go up there as being one of my favorites. It's Old Filth by Jane, I'm going to make sure I'm pronouncing this last name right, Gardam. Is that how you pronounce
it? I actually don't know, but that's how I say it too.
I recently also wanted to read this because the Times just did a profile on her because she just recently passed away. And this book is ostensibly about a man named Edward Feathers, who goes by the nickname Old Filth. Filth is an acronym for Failed in London, Try Hong Kong. And he is a barrister in England, and he goes to Hong Kong where he becomes a barrister. That's a lawyer for those of us in the States. And he then becomes a judge, and it's about his life, ostensibly, and his relationship to his wife. And I know from reading the Times profile of her, of the writer, that there is some secret in the book that in the first draft of the novel, the editor thought was too vague and wasn't revealed, so they made her go back and like write a letter, I think, to include in the book to make sure that readers get it or get what she's talking about. So I'm very anxious to sort of get it, like what this secret is going to be. But it's sort of, the book is sort of one of those books that's built like an accordion. You start out at the kind of end of his life, and then in the next chapter you go to when he was born, and then you go to another segment of his life, and you get these different kind of pieces of his life and work and career, and in particular his what I'm slowly seeing kind of tense, tenuous relationship with his wife.
And you have the fantastic experience ahead because there's two more books. It's a trilogy.
Oh.
And then you'll get to the wife's point of view, which is, I didn't know when I too read the first one with no idea that there was more. And when I finished it, and I have to tell you, if it doesn't sound appealing to you, ignore that and read it anyway, because it is one of the best books I have ever read.
Well, related to that is a question I wanted to ask anybody. At what point in reading that book did you think, this is one of the best books I've ever read? How many pages did it take you?
I think it probably took me to, I'm going to look at the chapters because I want to make sure I get this right. I think it was when there is a chapter, it's like the first or second chapter when we get the scene when he's born. And it's like the second chapter, and there's this description of place. And I'm a writer that loves any kind of writing that talks about place. And there's a moment where it says, all across the wide river, small waves slapped and tipped. Heat seemed to drip from the trees like oil. It was summer, the monsoon coming, and when it did, the river traffic would die. This was why they were getting the baby home and only one week old. Otherwise, he would have been stranded in the port where he had gone to be born. I just thought that was just like such.
Is it the writing then that draws? It's the writing.
Yes, and I do, and I think I know when a book is going to be great too, because it's something that Michelle Herman taught me, which is when you're reading the book and you're like, okay, I need to slow down because I want to take in every single sentence and I want to just like really enjoy this, because when you read a great book like this, they don't come around often.
But you're saying that you could hate the plot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I could die. Okay. Like, I honestly can tell you that like a lot of the books I read, sometimes I read for plot and I enjoy that, but some of my favorite books, the plots I will fall out of my head and I won't remember, but I'll remember a moment or I'll remember a character. Or as we were talking earlier of the book Transit of Venus, which I hope we get to talk about and sort of follow up on, you remember certain segments, certain like things that happen in the book that just stay with you, that stick in like you, that just sort of like a Kuckelberg, you know, just like sticks in your...
Which is interesting because I think most people would be the plot that would drive them to have a forever favorite, because that's what they would remember and take away with them through their life.
I mean, the writing is absolutely gorgeous, but the thing that makes me love a book is not plot, and the writing alone isn't good enough. It's the characters, right? Mm. And Old Filth is so and he becomes fascinating right in that passage that you read, because it ends with, it's as if the baby has chosen where to be born.
Yeah,
that hooks me. It's the point of view and the character. And I started saying, when I finished the book, I was brokenhearted that I had finished it, which is the way I felt about Transit of Venus. And then I was thrilled to find out that I was going to get to read another one, and then yet another one.
Did the other two books live up to the first one?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, the second one definitely lives up to the
first
one.
Who is this writer? Talk about this writer.
Let Nick talk, because I didn't read the profile.
Jane Gardham. She is a British writer. She experienced a lot of success in England. I think she won the Booker Prize, which is a huge international prize, but I don't think it was for Old Filth. I think it was for another one of her earlier books. But I do think that this book is a book that made her really popular in the early 2000s in the States. And I think it has a lot to do with being coming out with this in the Europa edition, which was really huge. Yeah. When did you come in contact with her?
It was just a couple years ago. And actually, I might have talked about that Old Filth, and it was through Old Filth. And I might have talked about it on the show. And I loved the book. It is fascinating for me to hear that you would choose it as your all-time favorite.
This is just why I'm currently reading right now. And I don't know if it's going to be
it's
my
one of my all-time favorites.
All right. All right. Yeah, that's how I came to her. And it was that she was being written up. And I did read the second one, I believe. I don't think I finished, went to the third one. I mean, I liked it, but I thought it was a great book. But I don't think I finished the trilogy. I think it was enough for me.
I seem to remember that the third one, it's been a long time now, that the third one wasn't quite as good as the first two, but I read it voraciously anyway because I had so loved, I think I liked the second one even better than the first because the wife's point of view was so fascinating to me.
Old Filth is our first recommendation. Give us
the
acronym.
We could talk about
again.
It all day.
Oh, acronym Filth. Failed in London, try Hong Kong.
Try Hong Kong. Try listening to All Sides Weekend Books, which you're doing right now here on 89.7 NPR News. Let's ask Cassie Rose what she's reading these days, what we should read these days.
Well, I will share a book that I just finished. It is coming out on June 3rd. It is called Flashlight by Susan Choi. Susan Troy won the National Book Award for Trust Exercise, the National Book Award in Fiction for Trust Exercise. So there is a lot of what energy around this book. I mean, you'll hear a lot about it as we get closer to June 3rd, which is really, I think, only about 3 weeks away. But anyway, it starts out, it's a really remarkable book. That's first, I have to say that. And it starts out with a tragedy, a family tragedy, where a man is walking along a beach with his 10-year-old daughter. It's in Japan, and he disappears. It is thought that he is drowned because he didn't know how to swim. She is found on the beach. Then what Susan Troy does is she goes back to in time to when he was a young boy during World War II and growing up in Japan. He is actually Korean, but his family had moved from Korea to Japan to get work. So he is growing up with the name Hiroshi, I think was his name, during World War II to appear Japanese. So we get that time frame. And what's going on for a Korean in Japan during that time and then also during the Korean War is absolutely fascinating, what she brings out, and is incredibly important to the plot of what happens. Well, the mystery then is holding us. And so then she keeps going forward. His parents repatriate back to North Korea. They fall for the communist.
North Korea,
uh-huh. Correct. So after the Korean War, they fall for the promises of the paradise there, that you will have jobs, you have a beautiful home. And he believes the boy, his name is Sirk. That's his actual Korean name. And he doesn't believe in the trickery. So he bolts and goes to the United States and goes to college, and he marries, while his parents, by choice, go to North Korea. And of course, he never hears from them again. Yeah. And when he marries, he denies to his wife, Anne, that he has any family. And that's another thing that sort of gets you in the book, because he is frightened. He is unsettled. Something about knowing that he has this communist connection that this is during, I would say, going through the 50s and then through the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so what Troy does then is he brings you up to this point where he's married, he's teaching in college, he gets a sabbatical, he has to go back to Japan. There's a little bit of pressure at his college that sends him there. So then she takes us to the beach situation, but that's only halfway through the book. And she doesn't resolve it at that point. She just gives you more information. And then she goes ahead to the daughter, Louisa, and Anne's lives. And you still don't know what happened, but she gives you much more. And then the doors open. The light comes in. And herein is it has to do with something that's, I'll just use the word geopolitical drama. And it's actually fascinating what she does. And I'll just have to leave it at that.
Yeah, please.
It's going to be interesting to see how the book is reviewed, because it'll be very hard not to give the spoilers.
Remind us of the title and author.
It's called Flashlight, and it's by Susan Troy, and the release date is June 3rd.
I didn't know it was coming, and I loved Trust Exercise. Did you read Trust Exercise?
I did read Trust. I read it when I was on, like, at a writing retreat.
Oh, mm-hmm. It was such a good book, and it was her first, and I've been waiting and waiting for her to. Oh no, was there one before that?
She's got a couple under her
belt. She has one called My Education.
Yes, I went back and read My Education, which I also loved.
Yeah, yeah.
This sounds very different.
I have to say, it's a long read. And I don't mean that just by saying it's like 450 pages, but she's very patient with developing the story and with the characters. And it's an observant narrator. So there isn't much emotion in it, but she's very precise in bringing out the detail of their lives.
Oh, I'm so excited about it.
We have to take a quick break. This is All Sides Weekend Book. Don't go away.
Thank you. Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
We are back with All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy here with Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, Nick White, who is leaving us to go to Harvard to teach. I add quickly. And Michelle Herman is here. And Michelle Herman's new book is called If You Say So, a new collection of essays, which, speaking of place, has some local interest, but it's being read all over the country. So, Michelle Herman, what do you have for us to read? Well, you should read If You Say So, but okay, I'll say that. You don't have to.
No, I'm not going to say that. But yes, buy my book. It's available at Clintonville Books. It's available at Prologue. They all have signed copies.
Yes.
The first book I want to bring to you today is a book I love and that I'm very intimately familiar with. It's called Alternative Facts by a young writer named Emily Greenberg. And she was a graduate student of mine, just as Nick White was once upon a time. And just as I directed Nick White's MFA thesis, which was turned into his collection of stories, Emily's book, Alternative Facts, was her MFA thesis. And it has now been published in a beautiful edition. It is an extraordinary book. I have read it several times now because, of course, I read it in manuscript and I read it in galleys. And then I read it again. It's changed a little each time. But what Alternative Facts is a collection of short stories in which the protagonists of each story are very famous people. They're fictional. It's fiction about, one story is about Thomas Pynchon and Paris Hilton and their wild night together. There's a story about Skinner, B.F. Skinner, and the Skinner box. They're entirely made up, but they are so completely believable, and they're almost like little like Cornell boxes. I don't know if you know Cornell, Joseph Cornell boxes. Mm-hmm. These boxes that are filled with objects that, when taken together, just create an entire mood and theme and. That's what these stories feel like. Each story almost feels like a novel. They're big and juicy, and you can really chew on them, and they're very funny. I think that Nick was the first person to read the Paris Hilton
story. I was, the Paris Hilton in a workshop. Thomas Pynchon, and I remember.
Okay, that is just so hard for me to put together in my head.
Wow, yes.
It's amazing. And the thing is, I've always said, this is a bizarre thing, but I'm going to tell you, I always tell my students this, that the sign that a work of fiction has completely got you in its grip is when you're reading it and you feel absolutely sure that it's true. And I don't just mean you believe that these characters exist. I mean, the example I often use is Bernard Malamud's A New Life, which is a novel from long ago, a beautiful novel. And I remember reading it in my 20s. And at one point, the main character who had been a drunk, he had been really down and out, but now he's a college professor.
I loved that book.
Right? It's a gorgeous book. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment when he is back in his past, and you get, from his point of view, this experience of sleeping on the subway in New York. And I had this second of reading is thinking, oh, so that's what this person I saw in the subway this morning, that's what he's thinking about? And then I, you know, immediately after, it's ridiculous. Bernard Malamud's never been homeless and drunk on the subway, but it was so believable. And when that happens, I feel like that's this moment of complete transport. And I swear every one of these stories. The first story is from the point of view of Kellyanne Conway, Trump's original, press secretary. And you get to the end of it and you totally believe that this is anyway. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's just a wonderful book. It's fun. And
hence
it's
the title,
smart.
Alternative Facts.
Exactly.
Right? Yes. Okay.
Exactly.
That's a recommendation from our own Michelle Herman. Again, her new book is called If You Say So. Now, what's Esmeralda?
Oh my God, Esmeralda is a ballet. So as regular listeners know, at the age of 62, I started taking ballet classes. I'm 70 now, and I have taken a ballet class every single day in those 8 years. I wouldn't say I've become a ballerina, but I know my ballet. And I've been performing in contemporary dance. It's really become an enormous part of my life. And one of our teachers, talk about incandescent, the incandescent Mara Fraser, who is a dance curator at OSU in the library system there, she just got tenure, has decided for the first time to have us do a ballet performance. And the 30 of us participating, all adult dancers, not adult dancers as in pole dancing, but, you know, adults who learn to dance, are actually going to perform ballet. We're going to do ensemble pieces. We're going to do an ensemble from La Bayadere, something from Firebird. And then there's a bunch of solos and duets. And she has assigned me the Esmeralda Variation. I will be in a red tutu and kicking a tambourine. While I'm on this subject, though, let me tell everyone about how writing and dance and also visual art are going to come together starting on June 17th at Urban Art Space downtown in the old Lazarus Building, which is now a gigantic art gallery. And the opening for that, which everyone is invited to, is on June 20th, which is a Saturday, a Friday. Uh-oh. I think it's...
Look it up.
It's Friday. The 20th is Friday. The 21st is Juneteenth on the Avenue. And there will be a dance performance. The place will be filled with paintings. I'll be reading from If You Say So. You can buy the deluxe edition of If You Say So with full color plates of the paintings. And I'm going to be teaching an absolute beginner ballet class for adults, especially older adults who have no experience. All of that information will be
she's
forthcoming.
She's looking at me when she says that.
And I'm looking at Cassie.
Christopher, I would love to see you in a red tutu taking a tambourine.
Yeah. You're moving. Go ahead. All right, let's remember, this is All Sides Weekend's Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, and I'm not going to wear a red tutu or any other color. Nick White, first of all, before you get to your next book, I want to thank you for a lot of things, but I want to thank you for Diane Oliver. You introduced us to Diane Oliver last time you were here. Diane Oliver died at the age of 22 in 1966. She was killed in a motorcycle accident, not before she wrote a magnificent collection of stories, which I guess has just been made available altogether.
It was just recently published by Algonquin, I believe.
Yeah, Neighbors and Other Stories. Listen out there, if you want to read something, some incredible writing that'll... break your heart and P-U-O. I can't say that. Can't say that. But you get the gist. Check this book out, Neighbors and Other Stories by Diane Oliver. Thank you for that.
Well, now, that book came to me by recommendation of Michelle and I's mutual friend and former chair of the English department, Susan Williams. She is doing some scholarship on that book. It came to her, and now she's become an evangelist for it, making sure that people read it.
Susan, you did good, okay? Thank you very much, Susan. And Nick White, what do you have for us to read?
So this is my last show in person, at least, and I've been thinking about a lot of books that have meant a lot to me over the years, ones that represent, I think, like writers that have meant a lot to me. And I want to talk a little bit about Anne Tyler, who I just adore. I would read anything by Anne Tyler. I've not made it through her entire oeuvre. I think partly because I would be sad if I still didn't have, like, you know, a Anne Tyler book, like, waiting to be read. But this is, I mean, I think any of her books in the mid-80s when she was, I think, like, writing at the peak of her, of like, her talents, I think she's still really great now. The Accidental Tourist, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant are just really, really wonderful books. But I love this one that I read actually during the pandemic, and I think it came out before those, called Celestial Navigation. And this is about, and I think it's because I relate to the character a lot. It's about this artist, Jeremy Pauling, who lives at the top of a boarding house that his mom runs. And he has secluded himself in the attic, and he makes these little tiny art projects that nobody probably would be interested in, you think, at first. And he's created this kind of world where he's blocked the whole outside out just for this kind of artistic world. And he's very shy, and he doesn't really fall in step with the rest of the world. His couple things happen that begin to push him out, first being his mother dying, and then a young woman comes to the boarding house. And the novel becomes a kind of what all of Anne Tyler's books are, I think, a kind of exploration of found family and characters who are, I think it's, I don't mean this derogatorily, but who are, I think we would consider quirky, but they're all very distinct, and then like learning to live together. And I think what I love about her and all of her work is that she is able to get at sentiment, you know, real earned emotion, without being maudlin or melodramatic or overly sentimental. And each time there are moments when I am reading her books where I have one of two reactions, and I was thinking a lot about this, where a character is thinking something that I thought I was the only one who has had this thought, or a character is thinking something or doing something, and I have this thought, oh, I've never thought of it that way before. That is such an interesting way. It's one of two kind of reactions to invoke the great Chris Hickey, you know, a book being either a window or a mirror, yeah. You know, and I think Anne Tyler is just a master of that.
That character, and I love Celestial Navigation too. That's kind of a prototypical character for her. Have you read the new one yet? Have either of you read the Three Days
in June? I have. Yeah. I liked it a lot.
I liked it too. It's you know, it's probably grade B Tyler, but grade B Anne Tyler is better than most people's grade A.
That's true.
But the husband, the ex-husband in that book, is another one of these.
Oh my gosh, totally. Yes.
Right? And Morgan's passing. They're just, she writes characters maybe better than any other living writer, if I have to.
I would agree with that.
You know, to this day, I don't remember which book it was. It might have been Breathing Lessons. I remember this moment when they're married, and one always knows what the other is thinking because of whatever song they're whistling.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? It's such a tiny little character moment, but I remember reading it and thinking, that is so genius as a way of quickly getting at what characters are like and what somebody is thinking about. And it's been, I don't know, well over a decade, maybe two decades.
Cassie, do you read Anne Tyler? Have you read?
I don't. No, I read The Homesick Restaurant decades ago, I suppose. Yeah. And I
was
knew right away
you.
She wasn't for me.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting.
I know. It's one of those where I've seen all of her books come out. I've thought, I need to pick up this. You know, maybe I should try it again. Maybe that was just a one-off that didn't work.
Well, but you like plot. I mean, you were talking, you really do. You're really interested. And there's no plot to speak of in these books. I mean, it's just characters and relationships,
well,
really.
Well, no, because there are a lot of books that I read that are not plot heavy. So I think it probably, there's something about the atmosphere, something about the writing, maybe something about the emotions of the characters. Mm. It was okay for me.
Yeah, it's not for everyone. You know, the writer Nick Hornby, who's a delightful writer, worships Anne Tyler. Anne Tyler so much that for years his email address was Macon Leary, which is an Anne Tyler character.
That's from Accidental Tourist,
yes.
I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, either you love Anne Tyler or you're meh about Anne Tyler. I don't think it's possible to hate her.
I've never read Anne Tyler, but I want to know one more thing, because you're leaving. I want you to have more time.
Okay.
So what else you got for us?
Okay, well, another book this is an academic book. Have y'all read Stoner by John Williams?
The most depressing book ever written.
It's a wonderful book.
It's a wonderful book.
Beautiful.
If you want to be really sad.
Oh, my God.
I don't think it's sad at all. I really think that book says that when failure means success.
I think so, too.
He never gives up.
No, he never gives up. Did you find it sad?
He keeps to his
morals. It's not that I found it sad. I think I found it deeply recognizable.
Yes.
And I found
yes.
it moving. And I think when I finish a book, it can't, and I know that it's good, it's great, it's one of the ones I'm going to come back to, it's more than one emotion for it.
Yeah.
But it was written a number of years ago. And
right.
My question to it is, it's about academia.
He's
a college professor.
He's an untenured college professor at the University of Missouri, which is the same place where he got his master's and his PhD. And it tells his life. And you know the summary of the book within the first paragraph.
Yeah.
And then I think one of the things that's really masterful about the book is the level of control that he has over the character, the narration. Everything is so precise. And one of the things I think that Cassie Rose was talking about, which is this idea of success and failure, is that it reminded me a lot. And again, I think maybe also if we're being psychological, these books all are rooted in some form of my own identity and past. But it reminded me a lot of when I was at Mississippi State and I was the graduate assistant of this professor who was a professor of postcolonial literature. And I helped him when his book was coming out, edit it. And it was going to be actually his last book because he passed away right before it came out. And he passed away at his desk. Like, they found him at his desk in his house. He was leaned over it.
Great.
Like at
I hope that, listen, I hope.
And I remember a colleague of mine who we were both grad assistants there, he came to me and he's like, "That's so sad. I hope I don't end up like that." I remember having the exact opposite. I was like, right, "That's not sad. I want to end up like that.
I want to be dropped dead on the microphone playing Mahler's Fifth Symphony. I swear to God, I will. I mean, I think that sounds wonderful."
But yeah, that was my response. Yeah. And so when I read this, that was my life response.
I think
response
the reason
to it.
I read it when I was first in the academy, early in my years as a professor, and I just had this, and I was so nervous. I loved it. I mean, it's on my list of top three all-time academic novels for sure. But I walked around like I had the weight of the world on my shoulders the whole time I was reading.
My question is the we hear a lot today about the politics of academia, which is really, for a lot of people, it drives people away.
Yes.
It drives people, really gifted people. Is he dealing with the same thing, remind me, in a book written, what, 70 years ago?
In some ways, I remember he's dealing with it in terms at the very beginning of the novel, I remember, because there's this big question of whether or not he's going to go to World War I or not.
Right.
You know, and if he's going to stay, if he's going to stay there. And that is something that weighs on him considerably. There's also like hierarchical politics, too, because he's someone who, in the politics of academia, you know, if you got your degree somewhere, usually that's not like a place you end up teaching. And he, except, you know, exception.
Except for Nick.
Yeah. And, and he's untenured too, I think, throughout the whole book. Yeah. And that's like in this particular setting, a kind of precarious existence. And,
he has a fight with his superior. They want him to be something, do something, and he can't do it.
Right.
So
it's not
that's
who
where,
he is.
Right. Yeah. He sticks to his principles and his, that's one of the things in the book that people like can't understand, and I don't think his wife understands it either.
Oh,
I
mean, his relationship to his wife, yeah.
Yes, so he has. It seems like the world is against him, but he holds to his standards, and he doesn't go through life unhappy. I mean, he is happy holding to his standards. Yeah. That's what matters.
He knows who he is.
Correct.
He knows who he is from the second page. We have to take a break and come back in 1 minute with more of All Sides Weekend Books. Don't go away.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
We are back. All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. I'm delighted to be the host of this roundtable. Mishigas here. This is with our farewell to Nick White. We have Cassie Rose, who is WOFC's book critic. We have author, dancer Michelle Herman, professor. And we have another recommendation from Cassie, WOFC's book critic.
I've got a book that came out, I want to say last week or the week before. It's by Graham Swift, who he's written quite a few novels, but I think this is my first book by him that I'm reading or that I read. It's 12 Postwar Tales is the title of it. Collection of short stories that are so, I needed this book. That's all I really needed this book because of the humane characters. And like, for example, there's one story in which a man is leaving his house at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's an empty house. He's 72 years old. His his wife has died. It's his second wife, and she was the love of his life. And he's on the way. You can tell he's on the way to a hospital, and you find out that he's a respiratory physician. And what he loves about leaving early in the morning at 6 a.m. is that he has time to think about his memories. And being 72, he realizes that most of the memories he has are the ones that are the early ones, like when he turned 10 years old and there was a birthday party. And you know it's the 1950s when he talks about this birthday party because the women are in frocks and that have beautiful flowers on them. You can just tell. And that's, I mention that because this is called 12 Postwar Tales. And that's part of what pulls all this collection together is that how after World War II, and not necessarily in just the 1950s, there's always some sort of a twinge that has a reach back to World War II or just the post-war years. Well, there's really not a lot that happens in this story, but what you find out is how he has gone back to work, how he retired, and how he's going to the hospital. But what you learn in this story is that just that very easy thing that we do go back to our early years. That is where the memories come most. And so it's him and the humaneness of him that really sort of strikes you. And then there's this other story, and it's called just simply Black. And it's a woman who is looking, in the very first paragraph, she says, I know that I did something in my life. I did this one thing in my life that was only 20 minutes, and it was back in 1944. And she tells this story about her and her friend Lily, who are leaving the factory where they were making the parachutes, and they get in line for the bus. And they see that there is a Black American serviceman that is at the head of the line at the bus stop, and a big space, and then everybody out behind him, and then a big space where everyone is queued up behind him, and then they're at the end. And they see that the bus comes, it's empty, straight from the depot, and he gets on first, gets in the seat in the middle of the bus, and by the time Lily and Nora get on, they can see the bus is pretty much full, but of course the seats before the Black servicemen, American servicemen, and after and beside are empty. Well, Nora, who is this woman who is looking back, she holds a rope at the top of the bus and stands beside the seat of where he is. And her friend Lily is looking at her like bug-eyed, like, what are you doing? And she says to the man, may I have this seat? And he looks up and says, of course. And so she sits next to this Black American serviceman that everybody is avoiding from the small town outside of London. Graham Swift is British, so all the stories are in England. And for 20 minutes, she has a conversation with him that nobody can overhear because of the rumbling bus. And that moment in time, she has never forgotten because it is one of the most important, and I'm tearing up here.
Yeah.
was the most important thing that she did. Of course, nobody knows it, but she remembered it, and she remembered how much she loved this man. She almost fell in love with him. So there's another story then of a woman who is it's actually the son, or it's the mother and the son. And he is talking, the son is remembering a time where about his father. His father is bombastic. He's always bragging about things. And he's talking about a time when the Crystal Palace existed during Victorian times and was moved. But it's the whole idea of this bombastic father and bragging about things that he doesn't really know much about. And the son is in this Crystal Palace. He doesn't understand why his father isn't talking about that memory and saying that he was there. Well, the mother then gets to a point where she brings that up. And I don't want to give anything away, but only to say, again, what Graham Swift is doing, there's this moment where all she does is say something in a sentence or two, and it is truly about what it is to love someone. Hmm. And it's only in what she says in a few lines. And that's the power of these stories. It's not that they're dramatic, like have a dramatic arc, like an Alice Munro story and something that you would come away and understand, oh, this is what happened. You come away thinking about the people, their humanity, that moment, and also that there are kind of moments that you have for yourself, too.
Oh, God, add that to the TBR pile.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Have you ever read him?
No, I've never read
him. I have not read him since his first book of stories, which was a long time ago.
He's written quite a few books.
And I remember loving it. I don't know why I never followed up with Graham Swift.
Well, having read this book, I'm now going to go back and read his books. And it's called 12 Postwar Tales, and it's by Graham Swift.
This is All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you, Cassie Rose, for that Graham Swift recommendation. Let's turn to Michelle Herman and see what you're telling us to read.
Well, this is one of the books I'm in the middle of right now. I tend to read three or four books at a time, but this is the one that's taking the first spot. This is the brand new novel. Nick, do you know exactly how to say her name?
I'm not sure.
Chimamanda.
Yeah, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Okay, good. Thank you, Nick. I didn't want to mangle it. It's called Dream Count, and I grabbed it at the library. I visit the library once a week. I did not know it was coming out. But it's about several women. The Chimamaka is a travel writer, a Nigerian travel writer living in the States. It's about her and her best friend, who is a high-powered lawyer, and her cousin, whom she's very close to, who works in finance in Nigeria, and then Chimamaka's housekeeper, who is raising her daughter in the U.S. And it looks very closely at their lives. It's just my kind of book. You know, it's all character and it's all relationships. I had so loved her last book.
Americana.
I loved it so much that I had then gone and read everything else she'd ever written. And this new one, it's painful for me. The entire first section is from the point of view of Chimamaka, the Nigerian woman who's a travel writer, because it's about her romantic relationships. And one in particular is described in great detail, and he treats her very badly, and she puts up with it. And it's a mirror for me. It makes me remember my own youth. And it really cost me a lot reading that section of it, but it felt so true, and it made me want to shake her. And she, you know, she comes through that into another place. But if you love reading novels about women, if you read Americana and enjoyed that, for sure you'll like this. But this is, it's just a complete immersion experience.
That's so good. I've been thinking about picking that up because I too loved Americana. Yeah. Really, really loved that book. Studied it when I was in my PhD program at Nebraska. That's like one of the books we read in our contemporary literature class, and I remember it was
a very special book.
Love that book.
Anyway, yes, I can recommend the new one.
Michelle Herman is here, Cassie Rose is here, and Nick White is here, and Nick White is leaving us. Nick White is going on to teach at Harvard. He's moving to Cambridge in a couple of weeks around my hometown, although I did not go to Harvard. I make that real clear.
Me either.
I did throw a football on the yard a few times, but the closest I got was the bus to my grandmother's
house. I've never thrown a football in my life.
In the next town. So I want to give you the rest of the time to talk about your books, and I want to ask you about what you're going to be doing in Cambridge.
Well, I'm going to be teaching creative writing, right, and I'm going to be the assistant director of creative writing there. I'm very excited, but I also, it's bittersweet because I have enjoyed my time in Columbus. I've enjoyed my time at Ohio State. Ohio State has, in my opinion,
how long have you been here?
I've been here as a teacher for 9 years, and I was here as a grad student for 3. And it's one of the best English departments in the world. Columbus was the first place that I lived in outside of Mississippi. I came here as a young grad student, and I laugh because Michelle came here from New York, and to her it was a very different experience. But for me coming to Columbus, it was like, oh my God, I'm living in the city, you know, and the city couldn't have been more welcoming to me. The university couldn't have been more welcoming. It was the perfect place at the perfect time for me in my life. Everything good and big that has ever happened to me that has changed my life has happened in Columbus.
Oh my God.
Including, you know, figuring out my voice as a writer at the wonderful MFA program, learning from great scholars in the English department, who then became my colleagues, meeting my partner, Josh, who I deeply love, who I'm going to be with
he's also teaching here.
Yes,
right?
he teaches at Harvard. He is a political scientist. So getting to meet him, you know, making lifelong friends, like Michelle was started out as my teacher, then became my friend, and is really like one of my best friends. Yeah.
I can't believe that one of my best friends is leaving me.
I know. And so, you know, everything that, you know, and so I have a deep affection for the city. All of my big life moments have really like happened.
No, he was
here.
Even in Harmony Project when he was a graduate.
I was here in Harmony Project. And getting to be on this show has been like a huge honor for me. It's really allowed me to check that box of like being a daytime talk show host, which I thought I was going to be when I was little and watched Oprah religiously. So I appreciate that. Thank you for cooking that off. But let's get back to books. I don't want to get too maudlin. And I have got a book with a lot of plot that I know Cassie Rose and Michelle Herman have not read. And this is a book. This is actually my edition, Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. Love this book. I read it when I was 14 because my dad, back in Mississippi, used to sell four-wheelers. He was like a small business four-wheeler thing. I'm getting around to it. And one of the places where he would go to take his four, like, because he was a Yamaha dealer, we would go around the state to gun and knife shows. And this was so boring to me. I mean, it was like hell for me to go to this gun and knife show. But I remember at one gun and knife show, there was a table
Keep
with books.
Keep saying gun and knife over
yeah,
and
yeah, sorry, 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 sorry. There was a table of books. And this was one of the books that was on the table. And I got it for $1.50. And I started reading it because I knew my dad liked the miniseries. And I had never watched the miniseries. And I started reading it with not really big hopes of if I were ever going to finish it. It was just something I was doing to pass the time. And oh my God, did it completely grab me by the throat. It was epic. It had these wonderful characters, these, you know, this ex-Texas Ranger, Gus, who was taking this cat, who's taking... this like herd of cattle from Texas to this place, Lonesome Dove, up in the north. And it's like all of these characters, they have so much on the line getting this cattle there safely. And there is a moment in the book that I remember vividly reading and thinking, oh my God, I cannot believe somebody was able to write this and capture it. I want to be able to do this. And it is when the cattle are moving and a thunderstorm comes and lightning strikes the horns that the cattle have, and the lightning is going through the horns and creating this kind of beautiful electrical show.
Wait, is that the moment that you became a writer?
Maybe, but I just remember reading it thinking, this is the most beautiful thing I'd ever read. Mm. It's beautiful, it's dangerous, it's surreal, and it just completely took my... And I was hooked then, I read it to the very end.
Yeah, I had a moment like that too in a children's book when I was younger, but I actually remember the moment also. It's incredible. The effect, I mean, books can have such a huge impact on us, but they do turn us into writers.
Yeah. Now, I don't write Westerns, and this is like, and I'm not really a big reader of Westerns.
People forget that he wrote Terms of Endearment.
Oh my
God,
people
remember the film with
book.
Shirley MacLaine, but I read the novel. The film was great, but the novel is much more powerful, I thought. I mean, really kind of punches you
in the mouth. He also was a screenplay writer, and he wrote the adaptation of Annie Proulx's story, Brokeback Mountain.
Oh.
And he won the Oscar for it.
No,
and, you
I
know,
Annie
Proulx's Brokeback Mountain is another story I could talk a lot about that meant a lot to me as a gay man coming up.
So. You got time for one more.
Okay, one more. Oh, my God. So I'm actually going to talk about two at one. Jane Austen, Emma. Love this book.
I'm reading that now.
Are you?
I've read it four times.
I love that book.
This book is amazing. For those of you who have ever wanted to start Jane Austen and have thought Pride and Prejudice, like, Pride and Prejudice is great. I love it. I'm not here to.
But this is the one.
Yeah. This is the one. If you want a sell to it, it's the plot of Clueless, basically. that is what this plot is. But it's so wonderful. Emma is such a great character. I love how the story... you're completely in her point of view, even when she messes up, and it's funny, it's hilarious. The other one,
the picnic scene.
Oh yeah. So good. The other one, To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. Now, if you really want to talk about a book where nothing happens, oh my God, nothing happens. But dear God, does she write some of the best scenes ever? And this is one of those books where you go in and out of characters' points of view, and it's just like being in a roller coaster of POV. And she is so expert. She guides you. She takes you by the hand. She never talks down to you. And you're just completely immersed in the world of this family as they are trying to get to this damn lighthouse.
The MacGuffin.
The MacGuffin.
The MacGuffin. Nick White, it's going to be Harvard's gain, and they need help these days. And Nick White is there on his white horse, going to go.
I cannot ride a horse, but I will kick butt
at Harvard and slap some sense into some people, you know, and that's going to be very good over there. Michelle Herman is dancing. When are you dancing again? Esmeralda, the ballet.
No, I'm not inviting people to see me in the tutu. But I am inviting you.
You spent 20 minutes talking about
it. I am inviting you to come down to Urban Arts on June 20th when we will be dancing a piece that I co-choreographed with my friend Mallory Rowell, and I will be dancing in it.
Cassie Rose, do you dance?
I do not.
I don't either. So, okay.
I did take dancing lessons at Miss Potts Dancing School, though, when I was, 10 years old. 12 years old. I learned the foxtrot and the tango when I was a little girl, but we were wearing white gloves and yeah.
Oh my. Mm-hmm.
I think I was in a movement class in college and the professor said, don't come back. Do me a favor, don't move.
That's chemistry teacher told
that's
me.
That's right. They also said you have no talent for music, but you got a mouth on you. And here I am 35 years later on the radio. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Nick White, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let us know what's happening with you. You've probably got a couple of books in the pipe that you're writing right now.
Right. And I hope that, you know, if you ever need me as a guest, special guest star to come zoom in, I'm always available.
Direct from Harvard.
From Harvard. Yes, please.
On the way to my grandmother's house. Michelle Herman, thank you very much. Cassie
always
Rose,
a pleasure.
Thank you all very much. This is All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you for listening.